and if we could, what kind of tremendous impact and difference it would make for regional security and stability.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to congratulate on the day of birth of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And leader of Islamic Revolution has rightly mentioned the importance of unity of Muslim nations on the 38th Islamic Unity Conference. See, when Sayyid pointed out towards the interference of U.S. And illegitimate support to the illegitimate regime, that is Israeli regime, and whatever it is doing with impunity, it is because of the interference of U.S. and support of U.S. When Muslims unite, that is the only solution. When we see the speech of Islamic Revolution leader, he pointed out that until and unless Muslims do not join hands against the external powers and external agencies who are working against the interests of nation and interests of region and interests of Muslims, therefore it is highly important time keeping in view the Palestinian nations, whatever they are facing from last many months. So it is the point of unity, it is point of citron for Muslims if they unite, and it will cut the external hands and external appearance and interference of the non-regional powers, including United States. See, Israeli regime is doing everything without any shame, that pointed by Sayyid, that it is doing everything and anything without shame. And it is not respecting the international laws and international human values. That is why we have to understand that why we can't control this state which has no respect for human values, no respect for international laws, and you see they are attacking schools and innocent people. They are not attacking any military targets. They are attacking schools, hostels, and anything which they see, or camps. That here, Sayyid pointed out that it is important for us to understand that until and unless we unite, they will continue to do whatever their target is, and they will be supported by the external agencies.
Right, and Sayyid, we should also mention that for decades, Western powers have exhausted tremendous resources to perpetuate disunity in West Asia, throughout the region, haven't they?
Yeah, that is now clear for everyone. When you see American authorities, say Hillary Clinton or somebody else, when they say we have prepared a syllabus in the one country, Muslim country, their syllabus is maintained by us, we prepared their extremism, we prepared their anti-Islamic agencies who will work inside Islamic nation, being Muslims, they will work for the our cause there, and they will disunite Muslims, and that is our strength. When important persons like that mention this thing, we must understand how they use our energy, how they use this sort of distortion of factors to get their targets. Here we have to understand it is not today when we see they are attacking the Palestinian nation. It is from many years they have worked on it to create disunity among Muslims and to yield their fruits from this dispute among Muslims. We must understand that we have common important points and common important belief system. We have Quran, we have Kaaba, we have everything common. We have Salah five times, we have fasting, we have everything which is important, we have common that. But they are making it very smaller, and the smaller what we call jurisprudent issues, they are making it big so that they will create dispute among the Muslims. They are working on it from years. They are creating discord in the religious field. They are creating discord in the political field. They are creating discord in the educational sects of Muslim nations.
Before we let you go, the Iranian leader said there would be no Gaza genocide if the region was better united, or for that matter, truly united. Your final thoughts?
Rational understanding. He will definitely understand this point of Sayyid, that when our Muslims go for unity, all the other elements who are working against Muslims, they have to run away. They have to move away. That will be the strength of Muslims over the globe. That is why external powers are not in a position to support this thought. If Muslims unite, they have not to go for a war. They have to boycott a single company, that will ruin that company. They have to boycott a single country, that country will be ruined. If Muslims understand their energy, Muslims understand the quality of unity power. That is why Sayyid pointed out, it is because of disunity among Muslims, we see thousands of people, thousands of innocents are killed in Gaza, and they are now attacking Lebanon, and they are not attacking any military target, they are attacking innocent people.
Thank you, Sayyid. Stay safe. Pleasure to have you on. Sayyid Mudassir Rizvi, Executive Member of the Assembly of Scholars of Jammu and Kashmir, joining us from Srinagar. Meanwhile, Iran's president also says Israel will not be able to commit crimes in West Asia if Muslims foster unity. Masoud Pezeshkian called on Islamic countries to stand shoulder to shoulder, adding Israel will be put in its own place provided that Muslims remain united. He was addressing a military parade in Tehran held alongside other simultaneous parades throughout the country in commemoration of Sacred Defense Week. Occasion marks the anniversary of the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s. President told different units participating in the parade that today no enemy can even think of aggression against Iran thanks to the country's defense and deterrence power. Also in the parade, Iran's armed forces unveiled a suicide drone named Shahed-136B and a ballistic missile dubbed the Jihad. Both are manufactured by the aerospace force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. Yusuf Mishahmedi joined us earlier in the port city of Bandar Abbas to give us more details about the military parade in Iran's southern city.
This is the largest military parade that is currently underway in Iran. And the reason for that, obviously, is because we have naval forces also taking part in this parade here, as well as, the Air Force and the ground forces. So from where I'm standing, one of the most modern naval vessels of Iran, actually, I'm standing on a Shahid Soleimani class corvette right now, and also another naval vessel from the same class, but it is one of the most modern naval vessels that currently patrol the Persian Gulf, and it shows how much Iran is committed to security and providing actually security in the Persian Gulf and the Hormuz Strait in particular, which is considered one of the most strategic straits in the world. Everything that you see here, particularly the military vessels, the naval vessel that you see from a Shahid Soleimani class, these are all homegrown military capabilities, defense capabilities, and this means that Iran will not be at the mercy of anyone in order to provide the security of its waters and, of course, of the region.
Iranian foreign minister says the Israeli regime will not achieve its goals by escalating tensions and provoking a regional war, but will receive a decisive response for its crimes. Abbas Araghchi made the remarks upon arrival in New York to attend the 79th session of the UN General Assembly. Araghchi condemned Israel for its criminal actions in Palestine and Lebanon, including the assassination of Hezbollah commanders, describing them as desperate actions by a regime that is caught in a dangerous deadlock. He emphasized Iran and other regional countries are closely monitoring the situation and adjusting their policies to avoid escalation. A top Iranian diplomat warned that the Israeli regime is desperately trying to drag the entire region into war. It is day now 351 of the U.S.-Israeli campaign of genocide in Gaza, and the regime in Tel Aviv continues pounding the blockaded territory relentlessly. In one attack today, over 20 Palestinians were killed in Israeli bombing of the Al-Fala school, sheltering displaced Palestinians in Gaza's Al-Zaytun neighborhood. In a separate strike, two Palestinians were killed and a number of others injured after Israeli warplanes struck a tent, also housing displaced Gazans near the southern city of Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, the health ministry in Gaza said five of its workers were killed after Israeli warplanes targeted a warehouse in Gaza's Muba area. Regime also targeted several other areas across Gaza with artillery shells, leaving an unknown number of Palestinians dead and injured. Israel's genocidal campaign began back in early October, and since then, nearly 41,400 Palestinians have been killed and over 95,700 others injured, mostly women and children. Death toll from Friday's Israeli airstrikes in southern Beirut has now risen to 31. That is according to the Lebanese health minister, Firas al-Abeid. A Lebanese official said victims include three children and seven women, adding around 70 others were also injured. The resistance movement Hezbollah says two of its commanders, Ibrahim Akil and Ahmad Mahmoud Wahbi, were among those killed. And in response, Hezbollah fired a barrage of rockets at Israeli targets, including the regime's main intelligence headquarters at the Mishar base in occupied territories. Friday's airstrikes in Beirut come just days after the Israeli regime detonated thousands of communication devices across Lebanon and Syria, leaving nearly 40 people dead and thousands injured. Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has announced that two of its top commanders have been killed in Friday's Israeli attacks on Lebanon. And one of the slain commanders is Ibrahim Akil, whose killing has been described by Hezbollah as a treacherous assassination. Here's a report on Akil's prominent role in the Lebanese resistance group.
The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has confirmed that its top commander, Ibrahim Akil, was among those killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Dahiya area in the southern suburbs of Lebanon's capital, Beirut. Akil, also known as Haj Tahsin, has a long history of services to Hezbollah with his military and security activities and played a significant role in a number of operations against the occupying Israeli regime. He was considered as one of the masterminds behind planning and implementing those operations. Akil was born in December 1962 in the town of Beit Nael in eastern Lebanon. He served Hezbollah since its formation in the early 80s. The Lebanese commander led the heroic battles and operations against the Israeli aggression against Lebanon in the 80s. The late commander was responsible for Hezbollah's central training in the early 90s. He also played a key role in developing Hezbollah's manpower capabilities. One of the turning points in Akil's mission in Hezbollah was his pivotal role in the 33-day war with Israel in 2006. In that war, Hezbollah managed to challenge the Israeli military by deploying complicated military tactics. Akil was one of the principal Hezbollah commanders in the 33-day war, which is regarded as a strategic victory for the Lebanese resistance movement over Israel. In 2008, Akil was appointed as the assistant to Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and remained in the position until his martyrdom. The slain commander also had a major role in establishing and reinforcing relations between Hezbollah and other regional resistance groups, including Hamas. When Hamas launched its anti-Israel operation Al-Aqsa Flood in October last year, Akil planned and oversaw the leadership of a backing military operation from Lebanon's southern borders.
That's it for today, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Why did Sudan reject the USL talks in Geneva aimed at ending the ongoing conflict in the country? France is fighting back after being kicked out of several African countries. Will the new scramble for Africa by Paris succeed? To talk about Sudan rejecting the US-led talks, we have contacted Donald Deya. He is the chief executive officer at the Pan-African Lawyers Union. And for more insight on France in fresh scramble for Africa, we have contacted Adib Sanim. He is the executive director at the Jati Case Center for Human Security and Peace Building. He's also a security analyst. This is Africa Today, and I'm Mubarak Kenya. Stay with us. The people of Sudan are enduring their 16th consecutive month of war with no end in sight. So why is Sudan engulfed in the current war that started on the 15th of April 2023? The power struggle between Sudan's army chief, who is also the president of the Transitional Sovereign Council, Abdul Fattah al-Burhan, and the Rapid Support Forces commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo was the genesis of the war of attrition in this third largest country in Africa. Now, as fighting rages, there is widespread disease and hunger. A staggering 26 million people, or more than half of the population, need humanitarian assistance. Sudan is now the world's largest internal displacement crisis. More than 10 million people have fled their homes since the conflict broke out. Now, the foreign-backed RSF militia led by Dagalo have been blamed for atrocities against civilians across Sudan. According to a panel of independent experts assigned by the UN Security Council between April and December 2023, the RSF and its affiliated militias were responsible for the deaths of 10 to 15,000 civilians in West Darfur. Now, since the offset of the Sudan war, there has been an array of regional and international peace initiatives aimed at ending it. So far, none have had any noticeable impact on the ground. The government of Sudan has rejected the latest round of talks led by the U.S. in Geneva. The Sudanese government is demanding that the RSF militia must withdraw from the cities and villages they have violated and occupied before talks commence. So why is the U.S. insisting on holding the so-called peace talks with the RSF militia, infamous for their atrocities?
Sudan rejects U.S.-led talks. Efforts to end the war in Sudan have failed to succeed due to the many conflicting interests of foreign powers meddling in the country. The Sudanese government says it is ready for talks with RSF rebels only if they implement an agreement signed in Jeddah. The war in Sudan, which began last year, has led to one of the world's worst humanitarian and displacement crises.
The people of Sudan are saying they've suffered enough and want a quick resolution of the deadly conflict.
It's enough. It's enough of suffering, displacement and uncertainty. There's no resolution, but just negotiations to end this crisis. Time is running out and the two warring parties must make concessions for the sake of millions of Sudanese people.
Now, one of the reasons cited by Sudan in rejecting U.S.-backed talks in Geneva was its opposition to any new observers or participants after Washington insisted on the participation of the United Arab Emirates as an observer. Now, Mr. Deya, should the UAE take part in these talks, considering the fact that the Khartoum authorities are insisting that the UAE is supporting the RSF rebels?
I think it has been established as a fact by multiple sources that indeed the UAE officials are backing the RSF. I think it has also been established as a fact that the UAE authorities are complicit with RSF in looting the resources of Sudan, especially its gold, especially coming from Western Sudan, the Darfur area, and laundering it through Dubai into the international markets. So, as a matter of fact, the UAE is a player in the conflict in Sudan. And I don't think that we can solve the conflict in Sudan without engaging all the people who are active in the conflict.
A panel of independent experts assigned by the Security Council says between April and December 2023, the RSF and its affiliated rebels were responsible for the deaths of 10,000 to 15,000 civilians in West Darfur. Is the international community doing enough to stop the atrocities and crimes committed by the RSF?
On all the crimes that have been committed in Sudan, especially those committed by the RSF in the west of Sudan, in the Darfur region. And I think one ought to remember that for the RSF, which is really a new name for the Janjaweed, they have been committing crimes with genocidal intent and genocidal impact from the early 2000s. The entire Darfur genocide, which has been before the International Criminal Court since the 2000s, is because of the RSF and the Janjaweed, who were designated or delegated this responsibility to kill human beings by the SAF. So I don't think the international community has been quiet in calling out who is committing atrocities in the whole of Sudan and especially in Darfur. But I think the international community has not done enough to stop these killings in Sudan generally and especially in Darfur, where we have seen genocidal killings having been escalated since April last year by the RSF and those who support the RSF.
Now, since the start of the war in Sudan, there have been several regional and international peace initiatives. However, they have all failed. Now, Mr. Deya, what's the reason for these consistent failure of efforts to bring peace in Sudan through talks?
In the talks, we focused on the men with guns and not on the people of Sudan, who should have been the most important actor and the center of everything. Luckily, efforts are being made now to try and make sure that the people of Sudan are always on the table, representatives of the girls and boys, the youth, the women and men of Sudan, and not just these armed criminals with guns. That might have some success. Secondly, I think there have been a proliferation of initiatives, different initiatives. You know, some headlined by the African Union, some headlined by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, some headlined by the Saudis and the Americans, some, you know, headlined by Egypt in terms of the neighboring states initiative. So there are too many cooks and they are not coherent. They are not sufficiently working under one big tent with a clear leadership and with a shared strategy. So we are all pulling in one direction.
The UN Migration Agency warned that Sudan is at a catastrophic breaking point with tens of thousands of preventable deaths looming due to multiple crises. There appears to be no end in sight to the war in Sudan, and interference and meddling by foreign powers, particularly the United States, is a major factor behind the escalation in this country. In a recent interview with Al Jazeera, Sudan's leader and army chief, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, said the foreign-backed RSF rebels have ignited the humanitarian catastrophe in the country.
No one wants to say that this is the rebel rapid support forces who are causing the famine and starving some areas in Darfur and destroying the Gezira scheme. Frankly speaking, those who talk about famine must talk about its causes and about the militias responsible for it.
Now, last question to Mr. Deer. What, in your opinion, will it take to end the war in Sudan and save this country from the current unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe?
Thank you very much. It is important to call out that the most serious humanitarian catastrophe facing the entire world at this point is the catastrophe facing the Sudan. There are more deaths in the Sudan than there are in the Gaza Strip, than there are in Ukraine. And there is a risk that there'll be even more deaths in the coming months, both due to war, people being killed by guns and machetes, and people who are likely to die of starvation, especially because we are facing an unprecedented famine. We're facing an unprecedented famine in the entire Horn of Africa because of drought over the last couple of years. But it is especially serious in the Sudan because for two consecutive seasons now, there has been no planting, no farming, because people have been chased away by the war. So indeed, it's a major catastrophe that we're facing, and it's a preventable catastrophe if the world steps in with humanitarian assistance in the short and medium term, and steps in to force a sustainable truce in the Sudan. So I think it is very important that the world steps in. What we have in Sudan is not just a Sudanese problem. It's not just a Horn of Africa problem. It's not just an African problem. It's an international problem taking place on the African continent, in Sudan and in the Horn of Africa. There are many implicated parties.
I would like to thank Donald Deer, the Chief Executive Officer of the Pan-African Lawyers Union, for his contribution today. Let's now take a short break before our next topic. Stay with us.
France in fresh scramble for Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Over the last few years, France has rapidly lost its influence in Africa after several countries rejected the negative influence of their former colonial master. African nations are saying they've had enough of French looting of their natural resources. There are many examples of how France has plundered Africa's resources. Let's take an example of uranium. France relies heavily on nuclear energy, with nearly 70% of its power coming from nuclear plants. Until recently, this Western European country obtained 20% of the uranium required to run these plants from Niger. Despite this significant contribution towards France's energy needs, Niger has one of the lowest electricity consumptions in the world. Now, these disparities are replicated throughout Africa, where Western powers have, over the past decades, plundered the continent's resources while Africans languish in poverty. The masses in the continent are rising, and this exploitation is coming to an end. In a momentous geopolitical shift, countries such as Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, and the Central African Republic have abandoned France while embracing the members of the BRICS bloc, particularly Russia, China, and Iran. But France is not taking these lying down and is striking back. The authorities in Paris have formed a new military command aimed at organizing military and espionage activities with some remaining partners in the continent. France, it appears, is reading from the same script of fellow NATO ally, the United States, which has an Africa military command based in the German city of Stuttgart. The headquarters of the French military command in Africa will not be located directly on the continent, but it will be set up in Paris. Now, this is clearly a new scramble of Africa by France and other colonial powers. So, will renewed strategy of neocolonialism and the plan of Africa by France succeed, considering the growing anti-French sentiments in the continent?
2 years ago, France had more than 5,000 military personnel in the Sahel to ostensibly battle terrorism. However, the decade-long presence of these colonial troops never ended terrorism. On the contrary, there was an increase in terror across the region.
After popular military takeovers in Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali, France was compelled to withdraw its troops from these countries. Now Paris intends to restructure its military presence in West Africa and make its troops look like security guards so as not to attract attention. But the people of Africa, like demonstrators in Burkina Faso, are resolute in rejecting French neo-colonial control over their country. Now France says it is reviewing its military presence in Africa and the French army is setting up an Africa command for the continent. Now, Mr. Adib, what, in your opinion, has necessitated this move by France?
Quite obviously, the French seem to be losing steam in Africa. This is in the wake of the military takeovers in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. We've had the French leave Mali. We've had them leave Niger as well. We have continuously seen deterioration in relations between France and their former colonies, with Russia stepping in to fill the vacuum. We have also seen a deterioration in trust and confidence between these former colonies and the French government, and there's been a lot of accusations traded against each other. And so I'm not surprised that the French are re-looking at their strategy in Africa, which I must say hasn't really been working well for them.
By the end of 2024, France plans to sign agreements with the authorities of a number of former French colonies on their associated participation in the African command. African governments participating in the latest French neo-colonial venture have come under sharp criticism from their own citizens opposed to French imperialism in Africa.
We've had some thinking that if they make any unfriendly gestures towards France, it might have serious ramifications on their economies, as a lot of these economies are very much reliant on foreign aid. And we do know that France has a great deal of influence so far as that is concerned. Some, I must say, also have existing pacts with France that they wouldn't, in my opinion, want to violate. So even though we have had a lot of Africans rising up to the occasion to say no to France, we still have some governments that are very much tied to the French administration in Paris. And so a lot of these countries, in my opinion, have no option but to hop on. But it's just a matter of time when the citizens would rise up to say, enough is enough and we are not going to countenance it.
The reformatting of the French military presence in Africa involves, among other things, the strengthening of espionage activities, sabotage. These destabilizing activities will be implemented by Brigadier General Pascal Yanni, an information warfare expert who will head the new French military command in Africa. it appears propaganda be a major component of the New Africa Command of the French military. Burkina Faso has banned several French media outlets, including RFI, for airing propaganda by an Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist group. A Burkinabe speaks after French radio RFI was banned in the country.
The press, whether it's international or national press, manages to divulge false information. It's interference in the country's internal affairs.
And now my next question to Mr. Adib. Now, why is France focusing on espionage and disinformation in its new scramble for Africa?
Well, you need to be extremely strategic with issues concerning Africa and how to exert some level of influence. Indeed, we have seen French military presence on the continent for decades on end. But quite obviously, things seem to be changing, and the French, like I indicated earlier, are losing ground. Hence the need for them to look at it from another perspective. One of the ways is economics, of course, espionage and information management. We've also had some thinking about how Western media has portrayed the East, particularly Russia, especially in the light of the Ukraine war, and so many other accusations that we are very much accustomed to seeing. But surely the world has changed. We now live in a digitalized space, with just a click of a button, you can ground a whole country. All right, so every country is looking into how they are able to control the information space.
Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have formed the Alliance of Sahel States. France is definitely opposed to this anti-colonial confederation and therefore continues to support extremist groups in these countries. The goal of Paris is to prevent these Sahelian countries from extracting their natural resources. France, which plundered the region's minerals and natural resources for many years, considers them strategic resources for itself and not for African people who are the rightful owners.
Africa, unfortunately, with all its rich mineral resources, from gold to timber to bauxite to oil, hasn't really benefited the people. I mean, a clear case in point is the Ogoni people in Nigeria. When Ghana first found oil, there was wild jubilations, you know, and I wrote a piece that was published in the papers. I was like, don't be quick to jubilate. We are in Africa and not the Middle East, for crying out loud. And that you could have all the oil in the world, yet fuel would be expensive, yet living conditions would not be anything to write home about. In fact, roads is a major issue. There are human insecurities. Why? Because others come in, and because of the corruption in the system, they are able to compromise. These officials who are the Westerners have been there since colonial days, all right? And that I find very unfortunate and painful, because they are able to succeed largely because our politicians are corrupt.
Now, just like the U.S. Africa Command, which exerts Washington's neo-colonial control of Africa from its headquarters in Stuttgart in Germany, the new French military command in Africa will be based in Paris. Quite clearly, France is pursuing a strategy similar to that of the U.S. in its new military command for Africa. Now, my last question to Mr. Adib. Now, what is the factor behind this decision to have the French military command to be based in Paris?
Of Africa doesn't lie on the current leadership. The young people are coming, and they are coming hard, and they are taking over, and they are realigning and redefining. And that's exactly what we have seen in countries such as Kenya and, of course, Senegal. And a lot more countries, I see prospects of that happening. So for me, no matter what strategy it is, when the people say no, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. For example, Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. But for some time now, the Russian economy is outperforming the whole of Europe, the whole of the European Union, because they have learned to a large extent be self-reliant. They have learned to not rely on the West or the petrodollar, which I must say, Africa has a long way to go to so far as that is concerned. Our economy largely relies on the dollar.
Well, there you have it. The young people in Africa have awakened, and what needs to be done to stop neocolonial powers such as France is to attain self-reliance. That's the opinion of our guest today, Sunny Adib. I'd like to thank him for his insight. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you, and goodbye for now.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
This for is a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Generosity is a virtuous trait that every Muslim should strive to attain. Generosity is the opposite of stinginess, as stinginess is a disease of the heart. The Muslim should avoid this bad quality, for it is a source of corruption. The Muslim's faith and righteous deeds purify his heart, so his hands should be outstretched, giving to those who are in need. But sometimes it is easier said than done. Imagine being encouraged to share what you've worked hard to achieve with a person you don't know. Even greed and materialistic perspectives dictate us to save, save, and save. But how? What is the result? Welcome to your very favorite program, For a Better Life. This is Nahid, having the honor of hosting you on another episode. But before we get started, I have to mention that I am sorry for my nasal voice. I just recently got a cold, and I'm really sorry for any disturbance it may cause. So, talking about generosity, as a Muslim person, we for sure know that it's one big part of our responsibility to share what we have with the other people, to be caring, to understand the other people, and be generous, like have our hands and arms open for the other people in need. We know that whatever is given for Allah's sake will never decrease one's wealth in a slightest. Rather, it will bless, purify, and increase it. But sometimes it is hard. Like I can say, I personally understand that sometimes it is hard for me to forget the very favorite thing that I have and try to share it with the other people. But deeply thinking, we may come to the conclusion that there are some ways for us to get to understand, get to be that much mature of a person that can be generous and having the mindset that if you're generous, you're not losing anything. As the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alaihi wasallam said, charity doesn't decrease wealth. Whatever is given in charity will be recorded with the one who has full knowledge of all things, Allah. He, the Almighty, says, and whatever you spend of good, it will be fully wrapped to you, and you will not be wronged. Whatever is spent will return, multiplied, and Allah will increase it in this world and in the next. When we just take a look at Quran, we will see that he says, the example of those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah, and their way is like a seed of grain which grows 7 spikes. In each spike is 100 grains, and Allah multiplies for whom he will. And Allah is all-encompassing and knowing. And also, we have it like another verse in Quran as well that mentions, but whatever thing you spend, he will compensate it, and he is the best of providers. And, you know, since noble characteristics are required like in different ways, Muslim works to develop virtuous traits according to Islamic guidelines. I mean, as a Muslim, we are supposed to act in accordance to what we believe in our religion. Allah says, and spend from what we have provided you before death approaches one of you. And he says, my Lord, if only you would delay me for a brief term, so I would give charity and be among the righteous. And the value of charity is like outstanding. For me personally, what has worked is that when I'm just trying to be, I'm not trying to, you know, we don't normally intend that being materialistic, but as a human being, we should believe that it's natural. Sometimes we want all the things for ourselves, and what has helped me a lot is that I keep repeating and talking to myself, like, charity is something that is going to be rewarded if I am, let's say, it's a so-called expression, if I want to say losing something, but if I'm just giving, it for sure means that it is going to turn around to me. I mean, these days, notions that youth usually use, whatever goes around turns around, it is the same for charity and for the good actions in the world. If you're doing something good, for sure, it is coming back to us. And also, what the other thing is that is always helping me when I am just trying to be generous and it stays hard and tough for me is understanding the devastating effects of a stinginess. We are going to talk about it more after a very short break.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. All I need. It's all I need.
Welcome back. The last thing about being generous that we mentioned was that when you are giving something, for sure, you are getting something more. And it is the rule of this religion, what our Creator has promised and what we all believe in. We must also not hoard our wealth and blessings, but instead recognize that He wishes for us to be compassionate. I mean, the Creator, Allah, is wanting us to be compassionate and share our provisions with the others without pride. We have it in Quran mentioned clearly. You who believe, do not cancel out your charitable deeds with reminders and hurtful words. The Quran reminds us that there is a recognized right for the needy and deprived over our wealth. So by giving for the sake of others, a Muslim is fulfilling a duty to those in need and preventing him or her from becoming proud of their own generosity. Now, explaining these facts, I mean, the things and the teachings that we do have in our religion, which are like boundless, let's take a look at what Saadi Shirazi, the Iranian poet, has written years ago. Needless to say that he's also a Muslim poet, and what he has written is kind of connected to what we are discussing today. Well, the topic of his poem is Discourse Concerning Riches. I'm going to read some parts of it and share it with you as well. The generous man may attain to perfection, although he possesses not gold. dost think that if a mean man became a Korah, his sordid nature would be changed? If he who trades in liberality obtain not bread, his nature remains yet rich. Generosity is the soil, and riches the seed that is sown. Give, that the root may not be destitute of a branch. Exert not thyself in the amassing of wealth, for evil is the smell of stagnant water. Strive, rather, to be generous, for running water becomes a flood. The miser who falls from position and wealth but seldom stands a second time upon his feet. If thou be a precious jewel, grieve not, for time will not pass thee by. It is the brickbat by the wayside that goes unheeded. Shavings of gold that fall from the scissors are searched for with a candle. You see, the value of generosity is also mentioned in literature as well. We have the poet highlighting the fact that even if you are gold, even if you are someone who is so precious, wealthy, and people are respecting you, still you need to be giving to the other people, as it is the human behavior and the human practice, let alone the Islamic religious practice that we are all supposed to do. Well, this is the end of this episode on generosity. Until another episode, I wish you health, I wish you wealth and generosity. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's Islamic Revolution says the cancerous tumor of Israel will be removed from the heart of the Islamic world if Muslim nations boost their unity. Israel pushes ahead with its deadly onslaught on Gaza, killing over 20 Palestinians in a strike on a school in Al-Zaytun neighborhood. And in Lebanon, the death toll from the Israeli airstrike on Beirut has risen to 19 as Hezbollah confirms the death of a second commander in the Friday attack. Hello everyone and welcome to World News. Now, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on Islamic nations to use their strength in eliminating the occupying Zionist regime from Palestine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei issued the call while meeting with participants of the 38th Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. Ambassadors, religious scholars, and academic elites from different countries were present. Ayatollah Khamenei pointed out Israel has been unleashing its anger at innocent Palestinians by bombing schools, hospitals, and camps after failing to eliminate resistance groups in Gaza. He said that U.S. support for the Zionist regime and its interference in the region will be overcome by unity among Muslims. Leader added, such unity will never allow the enemies, including the evil, corrupt, and wicked Zionist entity, to commit atrocities in the region. Meanwhile, Iran's president also says Israel will not be able to commit crimes in West Asia if Muslims foster unity. Masoud Pezeshkian called on Islamic countries to stand shoulder to shoulder, adding, Israel will be put in its own place provided that Muslims remain united. He was addressing a military parade in Tehran held alongside other simultaneous parades throughout the country in commemoration of Sacred Defense Week.